entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Well, hello there and a good Sunday morning to you. Welcome in to the best of Downtown. Brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Rich Kimble and Carrie Haskell here with you for our weekly look back at some of our favorite recent conversations. On the program this week, we'll talk a little football. Bob Soucy, the voice of the New England Patriots, gets us ready for their second game coming up late this afternoon. Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, the quintessential American sports writer, covers, as always, a lot of topics with us. And we get things underway this morning by featuring Carrie's conversation with Billy Hanson, a Maine native. He's a filmmaker, author, been involved in a lot of great projects, best known around here probably for his work adapting one of the Stephen King shorts into a film that was shown here, part of a Zone Radio event at the Opera House a while back.
Yeah, he did under the Stephen King's Dollar Baby film grant or film process. He did Survivor Type, one of Stephen's short stories, and did a great job with it. It's won multiple awards at festivals, still making the festival circuit. It's been out for, I think, three, four years now, because part of the Dollar Baby is that you can't release it commercially, so it continues on in the festival circuit.
Well, he's also the author of a brand new book, a collection of short stories entitled Spider Season, and Carrie had a chance to talk with Billy about that earlier this week.
Let's jump right into the book. Not only does your title of the book, Spider Season, which is an arachnophobe, gets under my skin right off the bat. The first story, Light Sleeper, starts off with a topic that made me feel like you may have scanned my mind for this, because ever since my daughter was born, I am the light sleeper of the couple, and my daughter, my wife, will sleep right through anything. I was getting the vibe that you might have, like, you know, been scanning my head for some of these stories.
Well, good. That's a good thing, and I worry about you slightly.
Well, yes. Luckily, it's never gone quite as far. I didn't meet someone coming up my stairs, but it didn't go any further than that one night. So.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah, Light Sleeper is a story that's probably the closest to anything real that's happened, you know, in the book. There was a night that I heard a loud bang in my apartment somewhere and got up to check it out and didn't find anything that fell over. And I just remember standing in the middle of my living room like, I definitely heard something. What could that have been? And then I was just so wired that I stayed up and just kind of wrote this story. And thankfully, the ending in my real life was different than the ending in the story. But up until the very end, that's a pretty real scenario.
Yeah, and one of the things, and it's not just this story, but some of the other stories in the two, the ending has such a nice upturn to it, in spite of the horribleness of it. The stories aren't straightforward, and I love that about, as I was reading through this book, there's so many elements in each of these stories.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's one thing that I've sort of learned about myself as a writer. I really want every story I tell, be it, you know, something like a 5-minute short like Earworm, or these short stories that kind of vary in length, I want them to be a full experience for an audience or a reader, you know, so a full, clear, fully crafted story, basically. And I think short stories don't really have to do that. There's a lot of them you can kind of just touch on an idea and leave it open-ended, or, you know, you don't dig too deep into an idea. But, you know, that's why I wanted to put these stories together for Spider Seasons, because they all sort of had this more full storytelling style.
Yeah. And it's hard because it sounds like I'm being vague, and I am in a way, because I don't want to give away too much of these stories beyond the sort of the initial setup of what it is, because the arc from that setup to where it ends up is so changeable. So covers so many areas that's part of the appeal of the stories in this book.
Oh, thank you.
The stories do run the gamut of horror, from the supernatural, you know, stalking the poor people, to the more mundane types of evil that people do to each other. Specifically thinking of The End of Edgar Wren and She Was Perfect, which I found particularly chilling. Is there a type that you find a little bit easier for you to write? Is it the supernatural, or is it the you know, person to person horror, or do they both have their appeals for you?
They both definitely have their appeals, but I think in terms of what I find strangely the simplest to write would be, you know, stuff like The End of Edgar Wren or She Was Perfect. This. If I can find something within myself, some dark part of my mind, like that I can sort of touch on and explore, then it feels like I'm sort of tapping into a vein and just letting the story flow out, because you can really get into that mindset. And it's, you know, at the end of the story, it's very creepy to have done that, but I think it explores a certain dark area of everybody's minds, where, you know, in The End of Edgar Wren, this guy is just sort of obsessed with his own death and how he's going to die. So he goes through his entire day and he sees his own death in everything. And I think that's something that everyone can pretty much relate to. You know, if you see the dangers in the everyday world, and this is just about a person who lets that sort of that tick go to its extremes and, you know, ends up doing horrible things in the guise of protecting himself and remaining safe. And I think when I get onto an idea like that, in that's a very rooted in very human emotion and human issues, I find that to be a little easier to explore.
Yeah, and that is a case with another story, the one that wraps up the book, Everyone Else is Asleep. It sort of takes those feelings that a lot of people have. In the case of Everyone Else is Asleep, it's, you know, I'm so sick of this routine life. And it twists it into something dark.
that one's the strangest one in the book. And I remember just having some images in my head of kind of what was happening to this kid, and that one I really found within the writing of the story what it was about and all that. But yeah, that you're totally right. Actually, that story is kind of a combination of the two. It's sort of building out this supernatural element that also reflects this this thing that we all kind of feel in that routine, and how to break that cycle, and if we even can. And yeah, so that's why I kind of put that one at the end, because that sort of encompasses all the different types of horror that I've touched on in the other stories.
Yeah, it has the added benefit of ruining some, a little bit of ruination of a great childhood character.
So another sort of personal story about that one is that when I was a kid, one of my earliest memories was that I used to have nightmares about Big Bird. And it was a recurring thing. It was the same thing every time. And I had this sort of big 4-foot Big Bird stuffed animal that used to sleep next to my bed every night. And thinking back, that was probably not the smartest idea.
Now, most of the stories in the book are sort of the traditional, what people think of as a short story. One of the favorite parts for me, though, was you included near the middle of the collection three screenplays that had been part of a writing competition that you took part in back in, what was it, 2016, the New York City Midnight, NYC Midnight. And also included an explanation of how they came about and why you included in the collection. Found those really fascinating reads. In the explanation, you say that under normal circumstances, they wouldn't have seen the light of day, and that was one of the reasons that you included them. You must still, though, labor hope that these get made as a visual medium, too, because or do you?
I do, yeah. The idea to put them in the book was, I was kind of assembling the book, or even just kind of toying with the idea of even doing a book with what I had. And I, those stories were sort of still fresh in my mind, and I really liked how they turned out. But with short films, you kind of hit this dead zone, if you will, where if it's too expensive, then no one's really going to put in the money to make it, because short films don't really make money, except for a few rare instances. But you know, they were good, and I wished people would read them. So I realized putting them in the middle of the book might be something special, might make the book a little bit more interesting. And it's a good way to put it in front of people and get them to read it. But in terms of having them produced in the future, I actually just had a meeting last week where I was discussing the book with a production company, and they asked me, like, do you think any of this could be adapted or could be expanded into features or TV? And I said, yeah, I think so. I think, you know, most of these stories could probably be expanded, but they actually latched onto those screenplays and said, I think we can expand these. And so it's definitely sort of a possibility. And I think people are treating them as short stories in the sense that they would be interested in adapting them. So the ideas themselves for those screenplays are still sort of out there.
Yeah, I mean, they were talking, there was one of them was called Electric Detective, a sort of a post-apocalyptic setting, though that was the setting, not the story. The Fantastical Nyla's Magic and the shortest of the three, The Red Helping Hand, they were just captivating stories. I don't know, this may be too old of a reference for you, but there was an old DC comic called The House of Secrets back in the 70s.
Yeah.
House of Mystery and House of Secrets. There were two different books.
Right.
But those are the type of stories that I grew up reading in those comic books. It's a sanitized version of the old EC comics and stuff.
Yeah.
So they just, you know, the imagery in them was just so captivating.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I find it interesting, you know, exploring the differences between the long form, like the short story writing and the screenplays, because the word usage is so incredibly different, but they sort of evoke the same kind of thing. So I thought that was an interesting piece to put in the middle of the book, to have this sort of change of pace after, you know, a couple of real dark, heavy stories, to have, you know, a screenplay you can just kind of breeze through, but get the same emotional reaction and see the same imagery and that kind of thing. Mm.
Yeah. So now, do you want to touch on some of the other stuff that you and your company, Dirigo Entertainment, has been doing? Of course, Survivor Type was just me and you talked briefly when you were up here for that screening.
Yeah.
That was a great, great short film.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, that Survivor Type short, it's still you know, it's been what year is it? It's been 6 years since I finished that, and still we get asked to screen it everywhere. This weekend is actually screening at the Jacksonville Film Festival in Florida. So it's still making its way around.
And is
to go as part of a Stephen King festival.
Right. I was going to ask, is that part of the reason that it has kept the interest, is because of its originations as one of the Dollar Baby adaptations? It's a little limited in the way that people can see it.
Yeah, it's definitely something that people reach out about. They find us on Facebook, and they, you know, I've gotten messages from people all over the world asking where they can see it, and, you know, what the status of it is, if it's going to be a feature. And, you know, it's really cool to see people find it on their own. But in the sort of Dollar Baby community, I think people know it and have heard about it, because, you know, there have been a handful of Stephen King Dollar Baby festivals at this point. And also, you know, word of mouth is pretty good for this one, thankfully. So, like, festival directors have seen it, and it's always a crowd pleaser. So the audience will have a reaction one way or the other to it. And I think that's what festival directors love. And that's just sort of given the film a life of its own, which is really fascinating and not something I planned for. But like I said, yeah, it's still getting around after 6 years.
Now, the other one film that Dirigle Entertainment and that you produced, but directed by somebody else that has gotten a lot of attention is Earworm.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was, I worked with a writer-director named Tara Price, and she and I met years ago on a movie that, my first job in L.A., she was the lead actress in this movie called Audie and the Wolf. And it was just a little horror movie, but we stayed in touch, and it was after Survivor Type. She reached out to me and said, hey, I want to write this short. Like, would you help me through the production? Because she never directed anything before. And my reaction was, well, I don't really produce anything that I don't myself write and direct. But you know what? Send me the story. Like, send me the script, and I'll see if I can help. And she sent me the script. It was 5 pages long. There was no dialogue in it, and it was one actor in one location. And to be honest, I was totally blown away. And I think just the fact that it was such a simple story and so efficiently told made me really want to be involved. And so Tara and I put together this tiny little production, and she ended up casting Ernest Thomas, who was in What's Happening back in the day.
Oh, wow.
So he gave this great performance. It's a 5-minute little short, very strange. It's sort of like a mini Twilight Zone episode. And it's been doing really, really well. That's actually screening in Jacksonville this weekend, too.
Yeah, everything I have not seen the entire short, but the entire film, but everything I've seen about it makes me really want to catch that one. It looks
good.
Intriguing.
Yeah. We're getting toward the end of our festival run now, and now that that's going to be wrapping up, we're looking at online distributors, and we've been approached by a few people who want to put it up on their, you know, a lot of people have independent Roku channels and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They screen a lot of short films. So we're looking at doing stuff like that now. So it should. We're hoping it's going to be available middle of next year, depending on how many festivals we're going to wrap up here.
Well, I will keep my eye out for that. Now, I do have to ask, aside from the obvious example of supplying the name of your company, Dirigle Entertainment, how does your early or has your early life growing up here in Maine in Aroostook County influenced your work?
I think quite a bit. I mean, I think that having grown up in Maine and all over Maine, like I was born in Aroostook County and I was there until I was maybe 12 or so. And then I moved just outside Portland to Old Orchard Beach. And all of that has really stuck with me. You know, I left Maine when I was 18. And I think coming from just that sort of hardworking, get through the winter kind of mentality that everyone in Maine sort of has to have, it has really made a difference in, of all things, my work ethic, I think. Because I do a lot more than a lot of people that I work with and a lot of my colleagues. And that's not to say that, you know, they're not trying hard or anything. But I think when I set my mind to something, I will just see it through and I'll get it done. So I'm able to handle the workload that I think I learned to handle by growing up in Maine. And then in terms of creatively, and this is something I've been thinking about lately, having done the book and looking at my body of work that I've already got behind me, I think that the small town Maine that I grew up in, there's a very strange atmosphere around the people in the town, just in the fact that everyone knows each other. Yet there are always things going on that you don't really see. For example, in Old Orchard Beach, I didn't find out until years after I'd moved away that there was a massive drug ring that was sort of running through the carnival downtown. And when I thought back about it, I was like, oh yeah, a lot of my close friends were really tangled up in that whole thing. And so just the idea that there are these this sort of darkness in a small town with the people you're very close with that you know very well. I think that is something that I touch on in a lot of my stories, whether I mean to or not. I think you can kind of find that in a lot of my work.
Yeah, there's lots of, having grown up in those same small towns myself, here in Penobscot County, there's a lot of secrets in small towns around Maine, and I think probably any small town anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, my dad, I've had a lot of conversations with him. He still lives up in Old Orchard. And he was always worried about me living out in Los Angeles. You know, there's all this crime and all this violence. And, you know, I've been out here for 11 years now. And he called me one day and said, you know, actually, my neighbor just murdered her husband. Like, your next door neighbor? And he said, yeah, it's crazy. And I said, I've never had a problem out here.
Yeah.
So there's something different about a small town and the darkness that can kind of live there.
Well, the book is Spider Season. It's going to be released on October 9th. Ask for it at your favorite bookstore. Get more information about Billy's work on the company's website, DirigoEntertainment.com. And Billy, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's Billy Hansen talking about his book, Spider Season, on The Best of Downtown. When we come back, Bob Ryan joins us to talk sports and more here on The Best of Downtown.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts. At 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person, and online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. My company is ClearPoint Financial. We're an independent retirement plan advisory firm located right here in Bangor, Maine. At ClearPoint Financial, we provide guidance-based, comprehensive retirement plan solutions to companies that are concerned about their employees' retirement income security. We focus on plan participants. We help them strive to achieve retirement income security. We provide ongoing engagement, education, investment advice, and service that exceeds expectation. For more details on our financial wellness programs, call me today at 307-7718. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Downtown Orono has a new pub and eatery, the Common Loon Public House. The Common Loon is a casual, relaxed place for great food, drink, and company in the heart of the village, and the perfect spot for a proper pint and a hearty or healthy meal. Open 7 days a week with lunch on Thursday and Friday and breakfast on the weekends, the Common Loon Public House features an eclectic menu with influences from over the ocean and close to home, serving up favorites for lunch and dinner like fish and chips, poutine, and pub burgers. Don't miss Wing Night Wednesdays, live music Fridays, and weekend mornings. The menu features hard-to-find dishes such as a full English or Irish breakfast. We're also home to the only wood-fired brick oven in town and offer a variety of pizzas and British pasties. Enjoy a selection of imported beers, local brews, and signature cocktails. Happy hour specials 3 to 5 and after 9 every night. The Common Loon Public House is the place to be for EPL matches, international rugby, the Sox pennant race, Patriots, Bruins, and Black Bears. If you follow it, they can show it on their 7 HD screens. 36 Main Street in downtown Orono, the Common Loon Public House is the place to visit before, during, and after the game.
Penobscot Theater Company presents...
Mrs. Robinson...
Sexy and sardonic.
You are trying to seduce me.
A boozy cocktail of comic drama.
Aren't you?
The main premiere of The Graduate.
Aren't you?
September 6th through the 23rd at Bangor's historic Opera House. Tickets at 942-3333, penobscottheater.org.
Plastics.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody.
Back on the Best of Downtown, your Sunday morning, September number 16. Well, Bob Ryan, at least this past week, a nowhere man, as far as the employers go, on vacation. Down in southern Maine, he's got a place there, but he's never unwilling to share his vacation time with us. Our conversation from earlier this week with Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Let's begin by talking about the Red Sox, who have 99 wins, who have clinched a spot in the playoffs, and yet everywhere there seems to be a great deal of hand-wringing by fans and media types. Why is that?
Well, there's very evident, and it's very rational. I'm so glad that people are not carried away with this numerology. They're going to win 100X games, whether it's 107 and therefore be the most, or 6 and be the most in the history of the franchise, whether it's the needed 113 to have the best percentage record in the history of the franchise, or whatever it is. They're going to have a gaudy regular season. We will have enjoyed it. There were highlight moments. Another one last night, Brock Holt, thank you very much, et cetera, et cetera. But if everyone's obsession in the end will be the playoffs, the fact of the matter is that I'll pursue you a question. Do you trust this pitching staff? Do you know if Sale's going to be ready to go? Do you know if Price is going to be totally ready to go? We'll find out something tonight. Do you trust Rick Porcello? I don't care if he wins 3 Cy Youngs. I don't trust him. And the bullpen is well documented what's happened since the All-Star game. And you turn around and look at your opposition, and you see teams that scare you. I don't want to mess around with Cleveland, with those arms they have. And to me, the team to beat is still Houston. I am cautiously optimistic. I love the team. I'm enjoying this season. Don't get me wrong, but any approach to the postseason, you've got to calm yourself down and realize that this pitching staff is very scary. That's what wins in the postseason, and I don't have full confidence yet that they're going to be able to. And now, just remember one other thing: neither Sale nor Price have a documented history of success in the postseason, at least as a starter.
Well, and of course, in the last couple of years, the postseason has become very much about the strength of your bullpen. So, did Dave Dombrowski make a mistake by not finding another arm or two?
I think he's certainly open to criticism, and he will be open to extreme criticism in that regard if that turns out to be the issue in the postseason. Now they've had the bullpen. The first half of the year was fine. I think nobody can complain about what we got out of that first half of the bullpen. The first half of the year, but since the All-Star game, the evidence, the records there. You know who could be the savior? It's Stephen Wright. Stephen Wright could very well be the answer to the problems and of getting you to the ninth inning. I still, even though Kimbrel isn't as dominant as he was last year, I like the fact that he threw 400 mile an hour pitches his last time out. And if he can get that breaking ball back over, I'll take my chances with Kimbrel. But to get to him, it could very well be that Stephen Wright will be the savior.
Do you ever recall, Bob, seeing a playoff bound team do what the Red Sox are doing here with Chris Sale with an inning last night, maybe two or three next time out?
Baseball has changed so dramatically, Rich, in so many ways. And this, people are going to be studying the success of the Tampa Bay Rays this year. And even already you can see some evidence that people are thinking that, this has been bandied about in the past, and just totally abstract, that maybe, you want to go this route of using multiple pitchers rather than the traditional starter going anywhere from 6 to 9 innings as a rule. They did it out of desperation. Don't get me wrong. It's not as if it has worked reasonably well. But this was a circumstantial here because of the Sale situation and the fact that they only pitched one inning had to do with throwing 25 pitches and the limit being 40, and they didn't want to bring him back in the second inning and have to get him out in the middle of the inning, blah, blah, blah. I'll buy that. That was a one-time only thing for Sale.
We're talking with Bob Ryan here on Downtown. A couple of weeks back, Carl Yastrzemski celebrated his 79th birthday. I saw you tweet out a birthday greeting to him and talk about the summer of 67 as being one of the greatest of your life. I wanted to ask you, is there a basketball equivalent that the Celtics have provided for you?
I wasn't on the beat full-time in 85-86. When the 85-86 season started, Dan Shaughnessy was the beat man. And I was in my first year back from the Globe after having done my year and a half at Channel 5 in Boston, and I was a general basketball writer or feature. I was just a generalist. I wrote a lot of basketball. I wrote college. I did features. And then in the January of 86, Peter Gammons left us for the second and final time to go to Sports Illustrated, to return to Sports Illustrated. And Dan immediately raised his hand. He wanted to do baseball because that was in his blood. And there was a need to find a beat man to pick up the rest of the basketball season. And they actually interviewed people from the outside. I remember seeing people come into the office. And I didn't really want to do it at that point and go back to it. But I finally, I don't know who came to who, whether I went to them or they came to me and said, you know, all right, how about you? Would you pick up the team for the rest of the year? So for the third time, I became a beat guy. And the first game I did was the first game after their traditional February road trip, and they played it in Hartford. Remember, in those days, they played three games a year in Hartford. And it was against the Knicks. And Bird put on a show. And I'm sitting there looking at it saying, oh, boy, I almost forgot how much. I mean, not that I wasn't going to games, but now I'm into it. Now I'm responsible for portraying this to the readers about what we just saw here. And I was immediately rehooked. And I'll tell you what, February, March, April, May, June of 1986 would be that stretch. That's the best basketball I've ever seen was the Celtics at their peak. And my favorite Celtic team, clearly, and I still think the best team of all time, and that team. And so the answer to that would be the answer to your question.
Sports Illustrated has come out with their list of the top 100 basketball players. Is there any doubt in your mind who's the best?
Well, that's different. See, I haven't seen this list yet. I'm curious, but I'm sure they're going to say Jordan, and I'll bet, and I'm guessing, and you know, the problem is, are we going to talk eras? No, the best, most impactful player ever on the court was Bill Russell. Okay, how can you deny that? The man from 1955, when he was a junior at 54-55 season, he's a junior at USF, until 1969. In that 15-year period, he played for 16 championships, including the Olympics. At the beginning of the year, the object was to win a championship 16 times. How many do you think he won? 14.
14, right.
So the discussion's over in terms of impactful. Now, and also, he was an athlete so far ahead of his time, he would totally flourish today. He would lead the league in rebounding and block shots without question, as he did. In fact, the rebounding isn't as good as it was in those days. So, no, but there's no question about that. So I don't know I'm curious. I'm guessing they're going to go Jordan. They're probably going to go Magic. They're going to go LeBron, which I think are the two best individual virtuosos who have ever played. I will certainly concede that. So I'm curious to see this list. Where's Larry Raitt, by the way? You want to tell me?
I haven't seen the top 25 yet here.
Because if it's rational, here's the other thing. You know, there's two things. There's two discussions at hand when you're talking about greatest. One is, out of context, and the other is you're constructing a team. A center, two forwards, and two guards, although now it's probably the way the game is played now, the center position is being being phased out for the most part, and it's really just bigs and non-bigs. But any list of the top 10 players, and very likely, and for some many people, any list of the top 5 players in the history of this league include 3 centers, because you have to account for Russell, Kareem, and Wilt. That only leaves 2 others left over, who were Bird, were Magic, and Michael. And I'll say they are the 5 best players, and I'll go with that. And then you start the next tier, and the next tier is very evident that it includes Magic and Bird and Kobe and Tim Duncan and Oscar and Jerry and I think that's pretty safe right there. And, you know, you can make a case for one or two more. Elgin Baylor, who's the most impactful individual offensive player in the last 60 years, is not being remembered the way he should be. And I would certainly make a case for him.
Boston College and Holy Cross got together to play football for the first time in a while. Pretty one-sided over the weekend. Dan Shaughnessy wrote about that. But for the young, for the uninitiated, Bob, take us back to when Holy Cross was a legitimate regional and national power in a couple of sports.
Sure they were. Well, first of all, Holy Cross set the pattern for, you know, the table for New England College basketball. They were the standard in the 40s. They won the national championship in 1947. They won the NIT in 1953 or 54. And that when the NIT was really important and as important as the NCAA tournament, in some people's eyes, more important. They have a great basketball legacy there and great players. And there's no question about that. They had to make a decision when the Big East was formed, and Father Brooks, the president, I'm sorry, I'm trying to get over a cold, hold it. Father Brooks decided the Holy Cross, he wanted to get out of he didn't want to go in that direction. He was going to pull back. They were a very small school, so they opted not to join the Big East, and they'd taken their other path, and their basketball situation is, you know, they're on a lower level track. They still care. They've had some very interesting NCAA moments of scaring the hell out of people over the years. But that's really where they are, just during the scare the hell out of people mode. Football, they were, you know, BC and Holy Cross was a capstone game for decades, 40, 50 years. When I got to Boston in 64, it was still very important. And here's what I remember. The ticket price for the Holy Cross game was a dollar more than ticket price for the other games at BC that year. I still have my stub from the 64 game, my first one, and it was $5 ticket, which was, really raising an eyebrow. Seriously. But of course it was an important rivalry. But then, of course, they just seemed to go in different directions. And, you know, of course, the great crowning moment in the last 50 years was Holy Cross beating BC in 78 and capping off BC's 0-11 season. But by the time that rivalry was ended in 86, Jack McMill complained about it. He thought it was terrible, but he wanted to keep it going. He thought it was just an appropriate thing to do, that they were friendly Jesuit rivals and traditional rivals and should keep it going. But it was decided to end it, and you saw on Saturday why it was decided to end it. And BC has got a pretty good team this year, and it wasn't much of an athletic contest, let's be honest.
Bob, I need you to put your film critic hat on. Now, I teach high school civics, and I'm looking for a movie that I can show my young students to make them believe and understand that our system of government and everything else can work in these troubled times. So I've narrowed it down to three.
Okay.
Which one would you go with, and am I forgetting one? I've got All the President's Men, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, mm-hmm. and The American President.
Well, it's so funny. As soon as you said that, I started thinking of the image of James Stewart that popped up in my head. That's the first one that popped up in my head. Now, that was Frank Capra, right?
Yes.
In 1939 or mm-hmm. so. And we were a much more innocent world, although God knows that the trouble was brewing across the pond and had already started. That's kind of old-fashioned, idealism that maybe we could use a dose of these days. You know, can we ever get back to that kind of a tradition? I think about a lot of things about World War II. Could we ever? I think about how we. You realize that Pearl Harbor was, obviously we know what the date was. 6 months later, we won the Battle of Midway. We got prepared enough to do that. I don't see how we could do that today. I don't think the country's built like that today. I fear. I don't understand. You know, I really worry about it. Anyway. All the President's Men, of course, I'm partial to newspapers, and you can't go wrong with that. I don't think at all. But Mr. Deeds, I think would be Mr. Smith was, which it, I think that would be should make sure to get to see that the way the world once what the world their grandparents inherited.
Absolutely, Bob Ryan. Great to talk with you as always. Thanks for making time for us on your vacation. Enjoy the rest of your stay in Maine.
Great to talking to you. Now, it's we really enjoy our. We are just an annual for the Ryans, and we're very attached to this to your state. So very nice to be here.
That's Bob Ryan here on the Best of Downtown. When we come back, we'll preview tonight's game two or this afternoon's game two of the season for the New England Patriots with their radio voice, Bob Seuss.
Hi, Baba.
I'll try again the whole thing. That's Bob Ryan here on the Best of Downtown. When we come back, we preview Patriots game number 2 this afternoon against the Jacksonville Jaguars with their radio voice, Bob Sosi. Coming up next here on Z62 Retro Radio.
Hey friends, Rex, Sparky, and Fiona here from Green Acres Kennel Shop in Bangor.
You may not know this, but being a talking pet carries a lot of responsibility.
You said it, Fiona. It's up to us to give voice to all pets who don't have a voice of their own. Right, Rex?
Right, Sparky. And what we'd like to say on behalf of all dogs and cats is thank you.
Once again this year, pet owners from all over have voted Green Acres Kennel Shop the area's best kennel, best pet store, best pet groomer, and best dog trainer, according to Market Surveys of America.
Thanks to Don, Paula, and the staff at Green Acres for making it such a great place for dogs like me and Rex to come stay, play, and learn.
And for cats like me to get the best quality food and care.
But most of all, thanks to you pet owners for putting your confidence and loyalty in Green Acres Kennel Shop year after year.
I guess when Green Acres Kennel Shop wins, we all win.
Yeah!
Hooray!
Right. Woo-hoo! Green Acres Kennel Shop, 1653 Union Street, Bangor. Online at greenacreskennel.com.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, our home away from home.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
Thinking of making home improvements to increase efficiency? Well, there's no time like the present. And the people at Penobscot Home Performance want you to know that efficiency main rebates have increased from $700 to $1,000 per zone as of May 1st. Also, anyone with Bangor Gas can get rebates for $2,000 per insulation zone up to $5,000. Call to get your free home energy audit at 469-6100 or visit PenobscotHomePerformance.com. It's the Best of Downtown. I'm Rich Kimball. Carrie Haskell here as well. Birthday greetings going out today to actor Ed Begley Jr. He's 69 years old today. Historian and author Henry Louis Gates is 68. Actor Mickey Rourke's got a birthday today. That's one of those that's hard to guess because, well, time's been rough on Mickey a little bit. What would you guess?
I would guess Mickey is like 55.
Maybe he looks better than I thought. He's 66.
Well, he's always looked old, so you get confused.
Exactly. Happy birthday to Mickey Rourke and anybody else celebrating a birthday today as well. Well, it's a big day for the Patriots. Game number two of their NFL season coming up late this afternoon as they take on the Jacksonville Jaguars in a rematch of last year's AFC title game. We get the lowdown on that from the radio voice of the Patriots, Bob Sosie. It seemed like old times. What a way to start the game with a Brady to Gronkowski, all's right with the world.
It's remarkable, isn't it? You know, all the talk all offseason, the intrigue, palace intrigue, the drama out of Patriot Place, reportedly, and the speculation about Gronk's future and how much longer Tom will play and how much they will be affected by not participating in the voluntary portion of the OTAs. And then the Patriots come out and defense gets off to a good start and the offense strikes, and none other than Brady to Gronkowski for the 76th time, a touchdown pass between those two.
Now, who's going to run the football this weekend? Jeremy Hill done for the season, and now a word today that Rex Burkhead missed practice because of a possible concussion. Who's left?
Yeah, Burkhead was out there today on a limited basis, but still you have to expect that the Patriots are going to continue with him if he's clear of protocol, to nonetheless exercise caution. They did sign Kenyon Barner, though I think that's a move that is made more to fill a need in punt returns, because Barner has been a punt and kick returner in the past and did so last year with the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles. We've seen him run the ball quite a bit in the preseason. He's been with the Eagles in the past, a couple of different stints with Philly, a couple of different stints with Carolina. So they've seen him a lot through the years, mostly in preseason play. But I wouldn't expect him to get a lot of carries. You know, you hope that Sonny Michel is able to come back sooner rather than later. Although he has been noncommittal the last couple of days and has been limited in practice, nonetheless, you know, reading into things, the mere fact that he was in front of his locker answering questions from the media yesterday is certainly an encouraging sign. They added Kenneth Farrell to the practice squad, a former Charger, who they signed and then released before and after the preseason finale. And, you know, potentially he could be a stopgap guy just to help fill the roster space. But it is a big question, Rich. And it was a question going into the second half last week when Jeremy Hill had the knee injury. You had White and Burkhead, and Rex ran it well. But nonetheless, you know, not a guy that you would expect the Patriots to lean on in those short yardage situations consistently. Bigger back like a LeGarrette Blount from the past, or, you know, going further back into a more productive player, Corey Dillon. So they don't have anybody like that right now on the roster, it seems. And, you know, maybe they're going to try to get through the next couple of weeks, or at least this week, without that guy before they try to identify one.
Now, on the positive side of things, that we had wondered on the offseason about the offensive line, they looked pretty good in week one.
They did. They certainly, I think, more than held their own against the Texans. DJ Reader, JJ Watt got pressure on the quarterback eventually, but for the most part, the offensive line was terrific. And Jadeveon Clowney, along with Whitney Mercilus, two guys who've wreaked havoc for a lot of teams, but especially the Patriots in the recent past, didn't really come close to Brady. Now, some of that was a design or the result of the design of the Patriots offense. They came out and ran the ball immediately, and they kind of went at Clowney a little bit. James Devlin early on that first series, you know, the cut block. And I think more or less, you know, helped to neutralize him in the first couple of series before Trent Brown did a terrific job standing up in pass protection. And Brown is a guy that is really an immovable player. It's hard to get around him when you're trying to rush the passer. He's a guy that's agile enough, though, and quick enough and athletic enough to be a force getting out in the screen game and as a lead blocker on a running play. So he's certainly off to a good start, had a good camp, and I thought played well last week against the Houston Texans. And overall, I thought the offensive line, the communication there, they didn't get crossed up too much in terms of the games, the stunts that the Texans used inside, the way the Patriots had problems with a couple of years ago in the playoffs. And on the flip side of that, Rich, I thought the defense played well overall. I know a lot of observers look at Deshaun Watson and say he's got a lot of rust, and that he does. He wasn't the same quarterback as last year, and maybe the Texans' offense was not as innovative as one would have expected for the first game with Houston coming in and now trying to finally get over this Patriots hump. All that being said, I thought the Pats defense played well from front to back, and I thought the secondary, you know, certainly showed a lot of progress over this time last year, just the communication back there.
We're talking to Bob Sosa here on Downtown. But with that in mind, let's look ahead to Game 2 coming up Sunday afternoon against the Jacksonville Jaguars. And not as big and not really a big offensive threat most of the time. And now with Leonard Fournette a little bit dinged up, but maybe less of a threat this week.
You know, Rich, that's a really hard read with Jacksonville. Fournette seemed to slightly strain his hamstring. And I say slightly only because just watching his reaction, walking off the field against the Giants, kind of a quirky play. He was catching a pass in the flat, and it was kind of a sidearm flip by Blake Bortles against the Giants, and kind of a nonchalant pass by Bortles, and Fournette moving along the line had to twist back and catch it, and then he started off the field. It was a third down play, and as he started off, reached for the back of his leg, and it took him in the locker room, and next thing you know, he's not practicing yesterday, or I believe today wasn't expected to practice. I haven't yet to see the Jacksonville injury report as we talk. That being said, remember last year he left the AFC division run against the Steelers. He had the ankle injury in the playoffs and came back and scored a touchdown against the Patriots in the championship game. He is their workhorse, and their offense goes through him. They're a team that wants to be very physical and run the ball, but if he can't go, they've got a capable back in TJ Yeldon, that's for sure. And last year the Patriots had some problems, especially early in that game, with the way Nathaniel Hackett, the offensive coordinator for the Jags, used all of his players. This is a team that really isn't laden with what you would consider above-average threats at the receiver position for the most part, or save for Fournette at the other skill positions offensively. Bortles certainly is a quarterback. He doesn't have a lot of respect still, despite a good postseason last year. But I thought Hackett did a really good job last year in the championship game early of getting a lot of different players involved in different ways. In Corey Grant, for example, a running back who seldom runs the ball, nonetheless had three big catches, all long plays against the Patriots, all setting up a score in that AFC Championship game. So maybe a guy like that has an increased role in this matchup. They've got to find ways to put points on the board for their offense. They do it with their defense, but the Jags really still struggle offensively. Just 16 against the Giants, only one offensive touchdown versus New York. And they're going to have to do better than that to beat the Patriots, I think, even as limited as New England may be. In terms of personnel, the receiver and running back spots.
That defense for Jacksonville, though, arguably the best in the league last year, 10 of those 11 starters back. What do the Patriots need to do to be successful against that D?
Well, Rich, I think the first thing is the Patriots want to get off to a good start and get the lead. And it's obviously the goal number one for every team at every level of football. But Jacksonville is a team that plays from ahead. Last year, they were 10-2 when they scored first. They only had one come-from-behind win when trailing at halftime a year ago, as good as that season was, and the deficit was 1 point. They were trailing the Chargers 7-6. And a lot of it is because of the way their offense drives the ball or doesn't drive the ball. They've got a very good field goal kicker, so they really rely on him a lot, and they rely on the defense to get points and force turnovers and apply a lot of pressure on the opposition. And, of course, if you play out front, with the lead early on, then you can be that much more aggressive defensively. And I think for the Patriots, if they can manage an early lead and force the Jags to chase, then obviously that puts the Patriots in a very advantageous spot. And when it comes to that defense, though, it's not just the pass rush, and it's an excellent pass rush coming off 55 sacks. Unique Ngakoue is probably as good a pass rusher on the edge as there is right now in the league. Very athletic player. 10 sacks last year, Calais Campbell inside, but they've got a lot of guys who can get to the quarterback. A lot of speed at linebacker. Miles Jack is terrific. And Calvin Smith, this guy's been more decorated, but Miles Jack, we saw him last year, from behind, stripped Deion Lewis on a play that was whistled dead. The Patriots got a huge break on that play. It could have been a game sealer for the Jags in the AFC Championship. And then there's the secondary. Probably the two best cornerbacks when you look at the tandem overall in the NFL, in Jalen Ramsey and A.J. Boye, and they've added to those corners with, I think, an upgrade at the slot cornerback position this year. They've got an early-round draft pick in the second. They're an early-round draft pick, their first pick, in fact, on the defensive line. So, they went out in the draft and tried to add to what was already a very fast and physical and aggressive defense. And it's going to be a very difficult game for the Patriots to go down there, deal with the crowd noise, try to block that front four, and make plays in space, and especially, again, without a Danny Amendola or a Julian Edelman to help move those sticks.
What is Jalen Ramsey thinking, though? Don't poke the bear, Jalen.
In most guys around the league learned a hard lesson when they've done that. My one concern, though, about Ramsey and this Jaguars team is they came in, remember, with a lot of bravado last year. They had a two-score lead in the fourth quarter in the AFC Championship. Ramsey had made the proclamation in front of the fans after they returned from Pittsburgh that they were going to win the Super Bowl. And they came in and they took it to the pass. They were undaunted. And, you know, they're still sore about the entire complexion of that second half in the AFC Championship, not just the fact that they lost, but the way that they lost. And you're right. He's had some less than flattering things to say about Rob Gronkowski, and I guess it was his way of complimenting Tom Brady to say he's not one of the quarterbacks around the league who sucked. But, you know, the thing about that guy, in speaking of Jalen Ramsey, is he's got the skills to back up a lot of what he says. Can he do it on Sunday? We will find out. But my concern is that, you know, this is a case of Jacksonville being similar to some of those Ravens teams in the 2010, 11, 12 years where they talked a lot. Mm. You had a guy like Terrell Suggs who ran his mouth, or the Jets teams with Bart Scott, and speaking of another Raven as well, who could come in and go head-to-head, toe-to-toe with the Patriots and back up what they said. And I think Ramsey and the Jaguars, they're brash, they're bold, and they're talented defensively. Yeah, so he put some things out there. He gets pictures, a lot of bulletin board material. No doubt Brady's going to give it back to him a little bit before the game and during the game, I imagine, as he did last year with the AFC Championship in Foxborough. But most of the Patriots want to do their talking on the scoreboard.
Bob, really enjoyed it. I got a chance to listen to it last night, your conversation with Mike Lombardi on your podcast, The Gridiron and Beyond.
Hey, Rich, I really appreciate that, and thanks for bringing that up. We're trying a couple of different podcasts this year, one on Patriots.com, and I would encourage your listeners to check that one out as well. I had a nice conversation with Mike Reese from ESPN, who's a New England favorite, of course, longtime beat reporter for the Pats. And honestly, it's really less about this year's team and this week's game, and more about Mike. I think people that have read him for years and know a bit about him will enjoy hearing more about who he is and why he does what he does the way he does it. The guy is so passionate about his role and his work with a love for sports and a love for New England. And then you mentioned Mike Lombardi. He wrote the book Gridiron Genius about his experiences with Bill Walsh, Al Davis, and Bill Belichick. Had him on the podcast. You know, again, a different type of format than maybe fans are used to listening to these guys on, rather than a 15, 20-minute sports talk Q&A. Where I'm going to ask them about players around the league or issues that are, in some cases, hot-button issues. We talked about the book and about his experiences and about Bill Belichick and the so-called Patriot way and the similarities to what Bill Walsh established in terms of the culture in San Francisco. And I'm fascinated by any work like that, whether it's for sports or a non-sports topic. And I enjoy the opportunity in a longer format, 30 to 40 minutes, to have a chance to talk to people like that and maybe, unearth a secret or two of the success of, someone who's gone on to great things. And when you talk about Bill Walsh and Bill Belichick, they certainly have done it in the football world.
Well, it was a terrific conversation. I look forward to reading Mike's book now. As well, Bob Soucy, the voice of the Patriots, the 98.5 Sports Hub Patriots Radio Network. Bob, we'll be listening Sunday afternoon for Game 2 against Jacksonville. Always appreciate you visiting with us.
Hey, my pleasure, Rich, as always, and great to be with you once again. I can't wait to see where you go on your next road trip in a Saturday morning quest for good coffee. I definitely take notes on your reports from around the world of college football.
Well, we'll be there for you bye week this week, but we'll be out in Michigan next week taking care of business.
Awesome. Good luck.
It's Bob Soucy here on the Best of Downtown as we wrap it up for a Sunday morning. Thanks to Bob. Thanks to Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and Billy Hansen for chatting with us about his new book, Spider Season. And thanks to you for making us a part of your Sunday. Hey, tomorrow we're back. We got a live show tomorrow afternoon. Going to be a good one. The Money Man will be with us. Eddie Money makes his yearly appearance on Downtown. This time around talking about season 2 of his reality series, Real Money. They've been re-upped for another year. Eddie will talk about that. Author Ellen Van Vechten on her book, On the Other Side of Chaos, Understanding the Addiction of a Loved One. Joe Harris-Simiak, Maine head football coach, sets the scene as the Bears prepare for their game against Central Michigan this week, plus Mike Lowe of the Portland Press Herald, and we'll get movie reviews from Alan Adams of The Main Edge on Pass the Puck. It's all coming up tomorrow afternoon, 4 o'clock on Downtown. Hope you'll be here with us as well. We'll see you next time on Z62 Retro Radio. You're gonna be